Welcome to Have You Heard. Have You Heard is a weekly discussion with musicians and people that just love music, where we get to ask you, hey, have you heard? Each week, Richard Dole and Matthew Altizer will discuss their favorite music or the music other musicians and artists simply couldn't live without. Find and explore new favorite music you didn't know you loved with hosts Richard Dole and Matthew Altizer. Welcome to Have You Heard.
Good evening. Welcome to Have You Heard. I'm Rich Dole.
I'm Matthew Altizer.
And Matthew, we are going to jump right into it tonight because this is our third installment of our long interview with Jim Pugh. Tonight, we'll be asking him listener questions. So when we posted on our Facebook that we were going to be interviewing Jim Pugh, several people posted several questions that they wanted to hear about Jim. And so, of course, we are more than happy to oblige our dear listeners to get the most from your radio listening experience. So tonight, we're going to hear questions from some friends of the show. But I think maybe we should maybe play something by Jim Pugh so that people understand like what we're dealing with here. Jim is a spectacular trombone player. If you've been paying attention to the past couple weeks, or if you've been visiting our website at www.haveyouheardjazz.com, you may have heard stuff from this album by Walter Blanton titled Eight. And each track is, the number of the track. It's pretty easy, except for number nine, which is Sonata. We're going to play a different track from this. This is a great album, don't you think, Matthew?
It really is, yeah. Not as good as Tromberry, but really good.
True. Tromberry that's a lot of fun. And
it's an amazing album.
And the best thing, if you go online, maybe to our Facebook page or in our on haveyouheardjazz.com, we will post a YouTube video of Tromberry playing at an outdoor Shakespeare festival in Bloomington, Illinois in 2012. And it's really great. The band just sounds amazing, but it's just like half the people in the audience, I think, are just going, what? And the other half in the audience are going, what? But half
the other half didn't even show up.
That's right. The first half is like, this is amazing. And the second half is like, I think this is really good, but I don't understand it. And that's how good it is. And I think this is the same thing with this album, Eight, by Walter Blanton, that features Jim Pugh, Bill Mays on piano, Martin Wood on bass, and Dennis Mackerel on drums, who's an amazing drummer. We're going to listen to track six, which is titled Six. And then right after that, we're going to go into a question from drummer, pan player, vibraphonist, Mike Kessler. So this is Six from Walter Blanton, and then a continuation of our conversation with Jim Pugh. Thank you.
from the Walter Blanton album. That was track 6, featuring Jim Pugh, our special guest for the past 3 weeks. Now we're going to go to part of the interview that Rich Dole did with the fine gentleman. And this was our listener question portion. And so we will have Mike Kessler, the great drummer here in Indianapolis, ask a question pertaining to the education of jazz artists.
This is from our good friend of the show, Mike Kessler, great drummer, vibraphone pan player in town. He asks, I'd like to know the changes that Jim has observed in musicians over the years. His career began before higher education in jazz was prevalent, and now it's ubiquitous. I'm curious to know if you feel, that has changed the music or the culture of jazz.
Ooh, boy.
Oh, boy. Should I hit pause and fill up our coffee?
No, not necessarily. It depends how honest we want to get here. No. I think it certainly has created an awful lot more musicians that are capable of like having changes thrown in front of them and negotiating them mm-hmm. in a pleasing fashion. I don't think it's created any more jazz icons than any other system created.
Okay.
You know, what I see happening and it's exactly the same as what happens in the classical training too. Cause it's like every classical trombone player sort of goes through the same list line of books. Maybe with slight variations or whatever, but the thing is that they end up coming out a very homogenized end product. And if anything, it seems to me the jazz pedagogy, because it all has gone a very, very similar path, which is basically in the chord scale relationship genre, and then learning tunes, all that kind of stuff, and transcribing. But a lot of it's, you know, chord scale relationship, you know, information. Right. That there's a lot of homogeneity in the end result. So that you have a ton of people that can play well, and you could play 10 trombone players, 10 tenor players or whatever, and you can't tell one from the other. And they all may be wonderful solos, but whatever that thing is, whatever that it thing, whether it's tone quality, whether it's the way phrases are made that come in the people that we listen to over and over and over again, I think the rarity of that is equal to the rarity of that at any other time. Mm-hmm. But you have more people that are competent. But I don't think you have a higher percentage of people that are like iconic.
Sure. Yeah. It seems like, I mean, everybody comes to jazz probably in a different way. It's somebody that they hear something
mm-hmm.
and they go down that route. And maybe the higher academic way of is kind of taking the uniqueness out of it a little bit. Or this is good and everything, the way that you got attracted to it, but let's go move back over here and learn all this stuff. I mean, does it take the initial fire out of, I mean, would it be better for people to just listen, transcribe, go out, play, listen to live performances, to go out and do it? Just like,
I mean, very possibly. I mean, there's a whole thing. If I look at, as I've talked to my students about this, like looking at this, there was a 5-year period between about 1924 and 1929, where basically I think the 5 or 6 trombone players that have defined what became 20th century jazz trombone were all born in this one slot. You have like, mm-hmm. Irby Green, Carl Fontana, Frank Rossellino, Bob Brookmeyer, J.J. Johnson, Dick Nash, possibly, if you want to include him in on that.
Yeah.
But they're all born in this one tiny chunk. And they all grew up independently of each other. There wasn't the recordings. They didn't have the recordings till like to listen to. They didn't have YouTube to go listen to everybody who ever played available to them. And as far as I know, aside from like occasional one-off lessons, none of them took private. So you have that they weren't part of an academic system. They weren't part of a pedagogical system that existed that they have to play. You have to play this book first and then this book and this book. A lot of them were self-taught. And Orby had his horn handed down from his brother Jack. You know, it's like they had trombones in the family they could hand down. So it's... So you have the same, and I think a lot of the fact that you have these voices that are so distinctively individual. I mean, inside of one note of any of these players, you can tell who it is.
Right.
Sometimes two notes. Okay. But I think that diversity of concept and style that makes them so unique and so individual is a result of them not being part of a homogenous prescribed system. Not that, you know, I think jazz pedagogy is great. I think it's incredible that so many people are getting the gift of being able to, you know, spontaneously create, you know, because it is an incredible thing to do that. But on the other hand, like I said, it's like those voices that stick up above everybody else. There's, you know, there will be those, but there aren't many of them in any era.
Right.
That was the other thing. Getting back to what we were talking about before, the one thing I wanted to mention, and this it certainly happened. It certainly was a big part of like classical instruction on any instrument is like, is this idea of like when things once wrong becomes part of the vocabulary, it's like you're sort of in like a weird, you're in a weird, sort of destructive place. And yes, I know there is, you know, I'm all for the discipline of, and the striving for perfection, all that kind of stuff. But because I've noticed this one, I've had classical players come and want to start studying jazz, is like the biggest thing is to break down this fear of playing a wrong note or cracking a note, or this is not right. Like, you know, you just got to turn out the lights, put away the music stand, close your eyes and just make noises, you know, just do stuff to try to break that down. And I think the one thing I see is a bad sort of upshot of the chord scale jazz pedagogy is as soon as you have those relationships, all of a sudden there is things that are now wrong. And I have a feeling that a lot of the earlier players weren't burdened by that idea of wrongness. You know, because all of a sudden, as soon as you do that, you close off an avenue.
Right.
In a way, once it's something, why I can't play that E natural on a C minor chord, you know. You know, I mean, not to get specific or whatever, but, well, yes, you can. If you know, there's ways to treat it that it could work absolutely fine, but it's you know, I think that's always a danger in trying to reconcile that with the striving for perfection.
Great interview question there from Mike Kessler, as spoken by the all-powerful Rich Dole.
I read it real good.
You did, and that was with Jim Pugh. I am Matthew Altizer.
I'm Richard Dole.
You're listening to Have You Heard on WICR 88.7. Thank you for checking this out.
Yes, thank you. And I don't know, Matthew, I love what he was talking about in terms of learning from your peers, learning from the street, if you will, as opposed to an academic institution, which is an avenue that's available to everybody, learning from in the real world sometimes is not a viable option these days.
Yeah.
So I think the way Jim explained all that was pretty interesting. So maybe to bumper that question there, we should play something from Trombury, The Devil's Hopyard. What do you think?
Yeah, any reason to play Trombury, I'm good with.
Hey, Matthew, it's Wednesday. Do you think we should play something from Trombury?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
I think let's play Hoofin'.
Nice.
From the album title is Devil's Hop Yard, still a great name for a brewery. From Tromberry from 2012.
True. Here it is.
Thank you. From the album by Tron Berry, featuring Jim Pugh. We're going to move on to a wonderful question from Gene Markowitz about Jim's time with the Woody Herman Orchestra.
Our very good friend Gene Markowitz, another drummer here in town, studied with John Von Ohlen, and great big band drummer. Yeah. He has a question. He said, what made leaders like Woody Herman attract and create such a lineage of great musicians?
Hmm.
I mean, other than the vast amounts of money that he was throwing at people.
Oh, I'm sure. Though, forget, right out of college, it didn't pay. It was a respectable, you know, it wasn't early retirement, but it was a respectable income for just graduating from college. But
it's not Tesla money, but you know. It's
no, what in. In Woody's case, I think it was. Boy, that's another really hard question because you know you're involved in like this is a band with a very five decade lineage, and there was Woody's relationship to the band was different almost decade by decade. By the time I was there, he was like. You know, to put out an album, actually right after I left, called The Godfather. You know, it's like he was like granddad to us in a way. You know, But I think he always had. First of all, he was smart enough to know really good writing. Like he wasn't a writer himself. He wasn't, and I don't think would have called himself a particularly spectacular. Instrumentalist. He was very, very good. Very good clarinet player. Very good alto. Very much in the Johnny Hodges. He loved Johnny Hodges. Yeah. I know in talking to him because I rode with him in his Corvette a lot between gigs and stuff. But in talking to him, he felt he was a very good editor. So people would bring in things and. Because a lot of the writers were young, they were very, very skilled and very, very good writers, good composers and stuff. But Woody would find ways to rearrange parts of a composition or whatever and make it work better. So I think he was really helpful with that for attracting the players. I think, particularly in Woody's case, it's because he gave people a lot of space. You wanted to be on that band because, first of all, the band got heard. So everybody, you know, when you're young and feisty, you're trying to make a name for yourself. You want people to hear how wonderful, you know, how wonderful you are.
Right.
You know, but Woody was a place that, particularly because he wasn't like a hotshot instrumentalist leader himself, the band took up all that. Like he had, you know, there were the feature places. He always had like, you know, since the days of Stan Getz, back to that, but these are thinking about, you know, Soundnestico, and like when I was on, it was Gregory Herbert, but like this pantheon of like high powered tenor players that, you know, that's like a tenor player, the ones like that, you know, that checkbox in there, right. You know. They want to be on that band. If you look at the trombone players from Bill Harris through like Phil Wilson, through Herbie Green, through Carl Fontana, through the lineage of Bill Watchers. I mean, look at the lineage of trombone players who are on that band. It's like, well,
yeah.
How could you not want to be on that band? Because if you're there, you know, in some ways are connected to that.
Sure.
That line.
But he created that environment to want people to be there,
yeah,
to give you space,
which I think he did early on because he again was smart enough. He had people like Jimmy Giuffre and all those people writing for it, that it sort of, and Ralph Burns, that sort of set this tone that this band is like trying to be creative. You know, Stan Kenton did the same thing with the, all those early Bill Holman charts and stuff. So we did sort of this retrospective of Bill Holman. And if you listen to Bill Holman's writing for different bands, it's like he's a totally different writer. So it's like a bunch of stuff like he did for Basie. It's very inside, very Basie. But here's like stuff written like 20 years earlier, like for Stan's band, where Stan wanted people to be very adventurous musically.
Yeah.
And he's writing these charts. There's a chart of his on I Got You Under My Skin that's like it just twists the thing inside out, you know. So but here was a place where you could go do that. So those kind of musical minds would have an outlet if they would go and work for somebody like Woody or somebody like Stan Kent. You know, it's like so it's and then it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like once you've set that in motion, well, then more people want to be on there, and you get more creative people sure. wanting to be there because that's an outlet for them, you know. Yeah. So it's like it just keeps snowballing after that.
Sticking with Woody, Patrick Swisher wants to ask you, what's the craziest story during your tenure with the Herd?
Nope.
Okay. That's what I thought. But, you know. Well, okay.
There's a time Woody closed the trunk of the vet on my head.
Oh. that explains it. Okay.
He had good. A Corvette.
Yeah. The Tesla of its time, right?
Well, yeah. For him, it was. Absolutely.
From the Woody Herman Orchestra featuring Jim Pugh, we're going to listen to America Drinks and Goes Home, a great tune by Frank Zappa, and The Meaning of the Blues. We'll be right back.
I think it would be, he can't not talk to you and not talk about Steely Dan. I mean, that's like a big gig, a pretty awesome band. That's some reputation
that's
there.
That's one of my only two gigs left.
Hey, yeah, well, yeah.
Playing gigs.
Yeah, that's my goal, is to have fewer gigs, but much bigger ones. Yes. Yeah, that's great. First, maybe for our listeners that don't know, how did you get hooked up with that band? How long have you been in there? And what is it like as playing with a more rock, touring with a rock band as opposed to, you know, jazz stuff, you know?
Yeah, if we're going there, I mean, the quality of the touring is very different. Mm-hmm. you know, the bus is very different. It's we have TVs and stereos and lounges and stuff in the bus, and we had our two little seats on the road, you know, the road band version of the same thing. You know, gigs are usually catered very nicely. You know, it's an upper level version of traveling. I mean, it's still traveling. I still, you know, miss being with the family and all that kind of stuff. But it's the other thing I've been doing it for, it's started, well, I guess the first thing I did with Steely Dan proper was the Two Against Nature album, which is like in 2000. So that's basically, we're closing on 20 years. I had worked with Donald before that on Comicariad, but nothing between then and the Steely Dan stuff. Got involved with the Steely Dan thing because he had welcomed Michael Lenhart into the fold. Trumpet player, absolutely fabulous trumpet player, one of the truly a genius musician. I mean, I think there's not that many people I've encountered that I really feel that about, but I think Michael is of that level. But in fact, he had received, he was given an honorary Grammy Award when he was 16 years old. So other people, not the only one that thinks this.
Right.
But anyway, so I think as a result of that Grammy, and I think Donald probably knew his father's like one of the busiest bass players in New York for decades, a guy named Jay Lenhart. I think Donald got hooked up with Michael. Michael was involved. So I had played with Jay. Jay used to do this Sunday Blue Note brunch at the Blue Note Jazz Club. I did that gig with Jay for about 7 years. And during that time, Michael was like a little kid, you know, it's like through the thing. So I was always like sort of Uncle Jim. So it's like when they wanted a trombone on the thing and Michael was sort of doing, helping Donald with some of the writing, all this kind of stuff, he said, well, we'll get Uncle Jim. So it's like, it's all connections. It's all, you know, it's
be
sort
nice
of like
to everybody, even kids.
Right. It's non-DNA specific nepotism, you know, or something. But anyway, but it's, you know, that's, well, that's the kind of thing I try and talk to, you know, again, with students about that. It's like, look around you. It's like all these people you're playing in this band with, you're going to be tripping over these people for the rest of your life. You know, it's like all this thing about who you know and following other people's careers, you know, that as you leave here and stuff is so important because you just don't know when stuff like this might happen. So anyway, and past that, and I remember in the beginning, cause I did the album. Then there was a lot of like, thought about whether, cause they had been touring with just three horns, just trumpet and two saxophones, but whether they were going to add a fourth horn. Cause it's, you know, you add one more person to this tour at the level the tour goes at, that's not a cheap proposition at all. So it was a big decision for them to add the fourth horn. I'm really happy they did.
Right.
You know, and from then on, it's just been a lot of fun. I mean, there's been a number of changes in the band. The band as it exists now has been stable for probably the last, close to the last 10 years, if not 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's really, the consistency of the band is just mind-boggling. It's like it never dips below a pretty high level. And admittedly, we're playing the same stuff like over and over and over a lot, but It's a very humbled and honored to be there. I mean, I know those that sound sort of corny, but it's, you know, sometimes we'll be sitting there playing. I'm just thinking, it's like, man, how lucky. This is pretty lucky. I know I'm not in the club playing a jazz gig or something, but right. It's like, this is really,
it's very cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Does it ever get old playing for that many people?
Well, the thing is, it's like when I was in New York, as New York shifted, because when I went to New York, it had basically been mostly a recording town, like a lot of jingles. We used to do like 20-25 movies a year. It's like there was a lot of recording work going on. And the longer I was there, by the time I was there for about 30 years. So by basically the last decade, that was all changing. And it came to the point that having a Broadway show became like the sort of the cream. That was like the cream work, which is pretty much what it is now. You need to have that. There's still some recording going on, but I don't think anybody can actually make a living doing just that much anymore.
Yeah.
And I realized in that it's like, I don't handle repetition very well. It's like, I wasn't a really happy camper doing a show, repeating it 400 times a year, you know. Steely Dan stuff, a lot of the tunes I've done every show we've done for the last 20 years, and it's like, I still love the show. You know, it's like the music to me is maintains my interest enough, and that combined with the people I'm working with, combined with being above ground as opposed to being in a pit somewhere, you know, all those things make it like the side of me that doesn't function well in a repetitive situation absolutely loves this.
It's amazing music, and you get the instant gratification too. I mean, I could imagine pretty easily how fun that would be for a long, long time.
Yeah, it did. And it shocked me. Well, even Woody's band. It was like, well, because I was quite a bit younger then. I was in my 20s, you know. And I, after 4 years of that, I'd had enough. You know, and that was very much the same thing, too. And I shouldn't have. If I look at it now, I'm also, you know, older, maybe more, you know, a little less of a jerk in a lot of ways, you know. It's like, cause you're young and ambitious and all this kind of stuff and blah, blah, blah. And when you get older, you sort of understand things that you need and should be grateful for.
Right.
You know?
All right. One question. You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but, sticking with Steely, what's the craziest thing Walter Becker has ever said to you?
Oh man, you should give me a chance to think about that one. I could have come up with something.
I got off, through that on you.
Off the top of my head, I actually can't. But there were things.
Well, I'll report back to Brian Robinson. Brian is a dad of Griffin's best friend.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
So he's a guitar player, good guy. So cool. Well, Jim, man, I really appreciate you taking all this time sitting down with me. And
well, I don't know how you're going to edit this down to something manageable. But
I'm going to, basically it's just going to make me look smarter. So that's how I do it. I have the smart
that
filter.
Shouldn't be that difficult.
Oh, come on now. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rich. We'll be right back.
gonna help you with that stuff.
You will just take your time and leave. Big heat and skank, get things unseen. You will get nature slinging and dread. Bars wanna bang the skulls, things undead.
Is recorded and produced by Richard Dole and Matthew Altizer in the studios of WICR. The theme music is by Brent Wallerab from the BWJO album Mezzanine. Feel free to follow us on facebook.com/haveyouheardjazz and do join us next Wednesday for another exciting installment of Have You Heard?